communities with visits currently held both in person and via online telehealth appointments. More information is available at ElliottCounselingGroup.com or by phone at 217-398-9066. And now stay tuned for today's episode of Disability Beat. This is Disability Beat, a public affairs program for and about people with disabilities. It's about social justice, community supports, inclusion, accessibility, freedom, and choice. My name is Vicki Nicewander, and I'm the host of this program and also the parent of a fantastic young woman with a disability.
The views and opinions expressed here are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of WEFT, its board of directors, associate station manager, or Prairie Air Incorporated.
Stay tuned. Well, that was unfortunate. Stay tuned for an interview with consultant, advocate, and parent Ed McManus on disturbing events at Choate Developmental Center, an Illinois institution for people with developmental disabilities. But first, disability news for the week of March 29th, 2021. The U.S. Department of Education is being asked to tell schools to direct significant funding from the recent COVID-19 relief law towards students with disabilities who have missed out on critical services during the pandemic. A broad coalition of parents, teachers, unions, and disability advocates filed a petition for guidance last week with the Education Department as school districts are about to see an influx of cash from the stimulus plan known as the American Rescue Plan. The petition cites many issues serving students with disabilities, particularly students of color, that have become worse by the pandemic. The new Federal Relief Act provides $122.7 billion for K-12 schools, 20% of which must be used for programs addressing learning loss. The measure includes an additional $3 billion for services provided under the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. The petitioners have asked the Education Department to clarify to school districts that they can use recovery funds to hire teachers' aides, psychologists, and other staff to create and implement learning plans, to provide transportation so that students with disabilities can attend school in person, and to help students with disabilities with remote education technology, among other priorities. While the Education Department has been clear that the requirements of IDEA remain in effect, the petitioners say the agency has been short on specifics and has, quote, failed to confront the hard questions posed by the pandemic or to set specific standards or best practices for how school districts should ensure that students with disabilities are receiving a free and public education. By law, the agency has 90 days to respond to that request. Airbnb is introducing a new menu of offerings aimed at neurodiverse individuals, including those with autism. The company unveiled a collection of online experiences this week designed by hosts with neurodiverse guests in mind as part of the company's push to be more inclusive. Though Airbnb is known primarily for short-term rentals, they also offer online experiences allowing people to explore new places or activities without leaving their home. The new selection of a dozen virtual experiences includes everything from inclusive skateboarding in Los Angeles to a street dance class in the UK and an opportunity to meet therapy llamas and alpacas in Oregon. Though designed to accommodate people with autism, dyslexia, attention deficit disorders, and others who identify as neurodiverse, anyone can participate in the online experiences, according to Airbnb. Family and friends looking for an activity to do together can sign up for the same session or schedule a private booking. Airbnb in the past has faced accusations of discrimination against travelers with disabilities in its rentals. In response, the company added more filtering options to allow people to find accommodations that meet their accessibility needs. The online experiences for neurodiverse individuals are listed under Inclusive Exploration on Airbnb's website. The U.S. Education Department is canceling student debt for more than 40,000 people who were previously granted loan forgiveness because of disabilities, but later had their debt reinstated after they failed to submit certain paperwork, according to the agency. The move targets a loan forgiveness program that was designed to help people with disabilities, but that critics say carries overly burdensome rules. After being granted loan forgiveness, borrowers are required to submit documentation of their earnings for 3 years. If their earnings go beyond certain thresholds, or if they fail to submit that documentation, they're back on the hook for their loans. Acknowledging challenges, the Education Department said it will relax the rules during the coronavirus pandemic and consider other changes to the reporting requirements in the future. Until the end of the pandemic, more than 190,000 borrowers who are now in the 3-year monitoring period will not be required to submit proof of their earnings, the agency said. Another 41,000 who had debt reinstated will again get loan forgiveness amounting to a combined $1.3 billion. The measure was a disappointment to advocates who have called for a total overhaul of the program. Student Defense, a Washington legal group, said the action helps a small fraction of borrowers eligible for the program. The group has urged President Biden to automatically clear loans for all eligible borrowers and to eliminate the monitoring period permanently. A senior department official said the agency is exploring permanent changes to the program, but they would have to go through a federal rulemaking process that requires months of negotiation. The program was created to help people who are totally and permanently disabled and unable to generate significant income. Borrowers are eligible if they can submit documentation of a mental or physical disability that has continued at least 5 years or is expected to last for that long. During that monitoring period, their incomes must not exceed the poverty level for a family of two in their state. And finally, Terry Liker, age 51, was a longtime King Soopers employee who was shot and killed along with 9 others last Monday in Boulder, Colorado. She was also a person with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Terry was a big fan of the University of Colorado's Golden Buffaloes Marching Band, who typically perform on Friday nights in an event known as the Stampede. Performances happen before home football games to rally fans' support in the heart of Boulder. According to CU Marching Band Director Mark Dockendorf, quote, Terry was there even before we started gathering, which is half an hour before the stampede started. She was just a staple. She was kind of a personal cheerleader for the band, end quote. According to Anastasia Moyes, a 2019 CU graduate now living in Denver, quote, I met Terry when I joined the CU Marching Band. I played cymbals on the drum line. She gravitated toward us, and so at every stampede after that for the 4 years that I was at CU, I would always see her there. She would even come to our marching band rehearsals and would watch us play. We would see her at the games sometimes, right outside where the marching band sits with her pom-poms and all of her CU gear, singing the fight song with us. I didn't know her super well at all, but she was consistent. She always came to say hello. She became a part of our band culture. We knew Terry was going to be down there. We're hurting since she's gone, and she was one of our biggest supporters. And that's the news for this week. This is Disability Beat. I'm Vicki Nicewander, joined today by my guest on the phone, Ed McManus. Ed has been on the show several times before, and he is with us today to talk about a very disturbing story that's going on, happening right here in Illinois in one of our developmental centers. Welcome to the program, Ed.
Thank you, Vicki.
So why don't we start by introducing you to everybody out there who has not heard your voice before. Talk a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Well, first and foremost, I'm the father of a young lady. She's not so young anymore. My daughter, Laura, was born with cerebral palsy, and she's now 44, and she lives in a very small group home a few blocks away from us. And as a result of having Laura, both my wife, Ellen, and I got very active in the disability community, and I ended up working for the Department of Human Services for about 18 years, I guess it was. And now, for the last 10 years, I've set up a consulting practice, and so I'm still very much involved. And I put out a newsletter on the disability system in Illinois.
Right. Well, you have a journalism background too, right?
Well, I worked for the Tribune for many years, so it's great to be able to kind of combine the journalism with the disability.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, why don't we start out by you summarizing what was in the news, your newsletter that I saw yesterday, and you said you put out a new one today, so we want to go into that as well.
Yeah, well, actually it was on March 15th that I published a newsletter that reported that a total of 9 workers at the Schott Developmental Center in Anna, Illinois, had been indicted on 16 felony counts during the past year in connection with attacks on residents of the institution. Just a very disturbing story. The workers were accused of breaking one resident's arm, choking another person. In one incident, 4 workers allegedly ganged up and attacked a resident. And in another incident, a worker apparently forced a resident to drink an entire cup of hot sauce. And so these all of these incidents added up to a bunch of indictments for these folks. And we don't really know much information about the hot sauce, which I think is the one that's attracting a lot of attention. Although the others were, you know, actual attacks on residents by all we have to go on is the indictments, which go in they don't go into a lot of detail. But we know that there were several people involved in this, and then there were several others who were accused of covering it up or lying to the police about it. So altogether, there were 9 indictments, and now one of the individuals has pleaded guilty to one charge, and he's got a plea agreement with the prosecution, which we all know is kind of what happens in these criminal cases, where the prosecutor has agreed to drop 3 charges against him if he will plead guilty to the 4th one, and then he was sentenced to probation for 2 years. So we still are waiting for word on the other eight indictments. Those people are all awaiting trial. But, you know, it's just upset an awful lot of people, and I have been kind of deluged with letters from my newsletter readers saying, you know, this is outrageous, and it reflects so badly on the fact that Illinois continues to be a state that relies upon these great big institutions to provide housing for people with disabilities. We've got 7 institutions, and we have 1,600 people in them, which makes us, I think Texas and New York are the only states in the country that have more people institutionalized than Illinois.
Yeah, and there are many states that have no institutions at all, and somehow they manage to function.
Yeah, I think, and people say, well, how do they manage? Because some of the folks in these institutions have very challenging behaviors, and the way that they manage it is by providing enough money to the nonprofit agencies to care for the people out in the community. And if you obviously, if somebody needs two-on-one staff or even three-on-one staff, if they need people around them at all times to protect them and to protect others, then the state ought to spend the money. And instead, the state is spending a huge amount of money, over $400 million, on these institutions. So they could shut down the institutions. I'm not necessarily saying every single one should be shut down, but certainly, I know the Arc of Illinois has said that 6 out of the 7 should be closed, and all those people should be moved out into the community, into group homes.
Yeah, and I totally agree. And there are a lot of organizations like the ARC who have been out there, and individuals who just feel very strongly about the closure of institutions that are out there writing letters and making phone calls every day. And it seems to have no impact at all. Maybe a story like the one that you wrote about this week will have an impact at some point. I hope so. But it's real, you know, and you talked about the hot sauce, you know, being forced to drink a cup of hot sauce. Yeah, that's very disturbing. I think it is also disturbing that somebody's arm got broken and the person who did it didn't report it.
Yeah. And you know, there has been an attempt in the past to shut down some of these places. The last one being at the Murray Developmental Center in Centralia, and that was in about 2013. Mm-hmm. And what happened in that one was that the parent association representing the individuals who lived at the Murray Center, they wanted to keep it open, mm-hmm. and they went to court and managed to delay the closure of it for a really long time. I think it was like 16 months or something. And this was an effort by Governor Pat Quinn. And of course, Governor Quinn got defeated in the next election. So the closure of Murray never took place. But the perspective of the people, the parents at Murray, is that the community system isn't very good. And maybe they may be right about it. I mean, Illinois spends less money on disabilities than any other state except for three. In other words, we are 47th in the country in our support of people with disabilities. And so those group homes out in the community are not necessarily all that great either. And so then the parents at Murray said, well, we want to keep our kids in the institution. And they managed to avoid the closure, and they're still going strong.
Yeah, the change from Governor Quinn to Governor Rauner really made a huge impact on the disability community. I know Governor Quinn, to his credit, did close two institutions.
Yeah, he closed Jacksonville, and then he was in the process of closing Murray. But then the election came, and he went out of office. And Rauner had said that he wasn't going to close anything. So now we have Governor Pritzker, and what I'm doing is trying to rally people to contact the governor. It's really solely up to the governor as to whether we will have these facilities and how many we will have. It's not a legislative matter. It's according to Illinois law, it's up to the governor. So I'm trying to get people to write letters and phone calls to the governor and urge him to do something about this.
Yeah. So you said you had a new newsletter that came out today with more information. What's in that?
Well, as I said, I got a lot of response to the one a couple of weeks ago, and in particular, I got this beautiful letter from a woman from Champaign, actually. Her name is Deb Ruesch, R-U-E-S-C-H, and she wrote a letter to the governor and shared it with me, and I included it in my newsletter today. And by the way, if anybody wants to read these. I do have a Facebook page. It's called McManus Consulting. That's McManus. So the McManus Consulting Facebook page. And I also have a page on LinkedIn that where I publish all the newsletters. That's under just my own name, Ed McManus. But so I published Deb Ruch's beautiful letter in which she is urging the governor to do something about our state-operated facilities. And then she just tells a harrowing story about her son, who spent 4 years at another center, Shapiro Center in Kankakee. And she said it was just horrible, and he was miserable. And finally, she was able to get him out. And now he's living in a group home and doing very well. But I think it's great that people like her are willing to step forward and give the details and tell their story. And people who read that can really grasp what a serious situation it is.
I think the general public at large thinks oftentimes that the institutions are there, they're doing good, they're taking care of people, and that it's, you know, people with disabilities have everything that they need because they've got those places. What they don't think about is they're locked away, essentially imprisoned, and have many of them no contact with family because they may not be able to talk on the phone or do FaceTime or email or any of those things. And families rarely have an opportunity to, you know, be a part of their lives.
Yeah, Deb Ruch very much compared it to a prison. I'm just looking at what I wrote here. She says, I can't claim to have witnessed physical abuse, but Dan was miserable. We worried about his well-being every minute that we weren't there. And the staff direction to the residents was typically bossy and sharp. And she really compares it to, she says she thinks that the prisons have better food than they had in Shapiro. I shouldn't be laughing, but it's a very sad situation.
Yeah. So if you were going to pick, I'm assuming that Shoat Developmental Center is the one that you're focusing on right now, but you're probably in agreement with a lot of people that most all of the institutions should be closed at some point, correct?
That's right, yeah.
Hasn't Equip for Equality been working on this for like a decade or more?
Yeah, more. In 2005, they did a very thorough study of, I don't remember now whether it was a particular, well, I have that here in my... I'm
in your notes.
I'm having trouble keeping track of all my... It was Shoat that Equip for Equality went after in 2005, and they recommended that it be shut down, but it was not, and here we are, you know, 16 years later, and it's still going strong. And then the case came before the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, the federal court, and they described Illinois as a laggard outlier in the national trend to get away from these kinds of facilities and to allow these folks to live in the community. I usually, when I describe it, I see two big reasons to do it. One is that it's going to save the state a lot of money. It's just so costly to run these institutions. And the other is just that the people deserve it. They deserve to be able to live like you and I on a regular street in a regular neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And if it costs some money to provide staff to make sure that everything goes right, because these people are not necessarily, a lot of them are hard to care for, and they have unusual behaviors and stuff. But that can be done in the community as well as in some big institution. And, mm-hmm. And as you mentioned, that's what a lot of other states have chosen to do.
And the average cost of supporting somebody in an institution is, it's got to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $350,000, $400,000 a year at this point. There's a whole lot of support that you could provide for someone for that amount of money.
Absolutely. I mean, in the case of Jacksonville years ago, I was told that the average there was about $200,000. And then they moved 180 people out into the community, and they were only spending $100,000, that's per year, on them. So in other words, they were spending half of what it was costing them in the institution.
Yeah. So, yeah, money saver for sure. But better than that, it's better quality of life for those people.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the offenses that you wrote about in your newsletter, those occurred over a period of time, I'm assuming. But also with the Quit for Equality in their report 16 years ago, there were a number of offenses listed out at that point as well. Is this something that has been continuous over the years, or is it something that just is dependent on the staff that are working at the time?
Well, you know, there hasn't been any real publicity about this sort of thing. The state kind of keeps it under wraps, and they don't really want the public to know all the gory details. I got a letter from a worker at Schott who was feeling very bad that I was criticizing Schott, and she said, you know, there's a lot of us who work here who are trying to do a good job. And I wrote back to her and I said, I understand that completely. But, you know, she was sort of suggesting that I shouldn't have written the story because it slanders the whole institution. Well, what would she have me do? Just keep it quiet? You know, we had 9 people indicted in the course of 1 year. And so it's, to me, that sounds like a pretty serious problem going on, and we can't just sweep it under the rug.
Absolutely. So if people want more information about this, and I'm sure you're going to be coming out with more and kind of helping to lead the charge on this effort, tell everyone again how they can get a hold of your newsletter.
If they go on Facebook, the name of my organization is McManus Consulting. If they go on LinkedIn, they can find me, Ed McManus, and I have the newsletter every time I put out a newsletter. I usually do them once a month, but lately I've been doing special editions because things like this crop up in the course of the month. And certainly if anybody wants to get, you know, one of the what my business is consulting for provider agencies, that is the nonprofit agencies that run the group homes. And I do a lot of consulting for them, but I also do consulting for families because we got a lot of families out there, including both yours and mine, Vicki, mm-hmm. who have gone through, you know, having to deal with a very complicated and difficult service system in order to figure out what kind of life our kids are going to lead. And so I receive a lot of calls from families just asking for advice.
And I know they're all very grateful for your help. We're running out of time, Ed, but I really appreciate the time that you spent with us today. So thank you for that, and thank you for the work that you do.
Well, you're very welcome, and thanks for having me.
Sure. Ed McManus of McManus Consulting. This and other episodes of Disability Beat are available at weft.org/public affairs. For updates and information, join our Facebook page at Disability Beat Radio. To share ideas for guests or topics, email Vicki at disabilitybeat@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in and have a great rest of your week. Down, gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. No, I won't. And you are listening to WEFT Champaign 90.1 FM up